Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And oh boy, today, I guess you could say that On the Menu is going to the birds.
Going to the birds. Well, the funny part about it is last week we had ladies or women, depending on which way you'd like to call them. Now, in the colloquial of my native land, birds is absolutely...
The
birds are actually girls. So we're on birds this week again. Women have taken over the world one more time. Not really, folks. We've got a forager and a hunter who's an expert on game birds. We've got an expert on the cooking of chicken. And finally, we've got someone who thinks you should put an egg on everything. So it all seemed like birds to me.
Well,
so.
And then a slightly different order. We start off with John Ash and his book, Culinary Birds.
Right. I forgot the order I put them
in. Yeah, and then we move on to Hank Shaw with Duck, Duck, Goose. And finally, we have the book, I guess an egg came before the... Laura Ferroni did the put an egg on it. So
something like
eggs,
that.
Yeah.
Which came first? Well, in our case, it's the chickens, but you could argue it's the eggs, and you can have that argument yourself, because we're just going to get on with the program.
Chef John Ash is a James Beard Award-winning author, teacher, and restaurateur. I like best, John, that you're called the father of wine country cuisine. That's a grand title.
Isn't that great? At least they don't call me grandfather, you know.
Now, how did you get to be the father of wine country cuisine, for heaven's sake?
Well, honey, because I've been around. I live in Sonoma County in Northern California. I've been around for such a long time. And I was one of the first to really try to put food and wine together, do it in a very conscious way. And it's funny that you asked that question, because I was talking to somebody else recently, and they were asking me about that time. I said, well, you know, when I started in Sonoma County in 1979, there were only a handful, really, of wineries here and in the Napa Valley also. And it was interesting that there wasn't much going on to trying to bring food and wine together. So,
well, I like Sonoma. I like it better than Napa.
Now we're going to make a big switch, and we're going to go all the way from wine country cuisine to chicken.
Oh, yeah. This is his latest book, John Ash's latest book, is called Culinary Birds, The Ultimate Poultry Cookbook. And, boy, is this thorough, John.
Well, thanks.
Tells you just about everything you need to know about cooking poultry. Not even just cooking it, raising it sustainably. Is this intended as like a handbook?
Kind of, yeah. You know, rather than just have a chicken book and, you know, have a few chicken recipes and stuff, we tried to really survey a little bit of the history of how birds came to us, and it's fascinating. Of course,
that I loved. I loved.
Asia was kind of the birthplace for that, so there are a fair number of Asian-inspired recipes in the book. And it's also important to know about how birds are raised, the birds that we eat now, because there's a lot of controversy about some of the conventional husbandry.
I have an update. The joke about why did the chicken cross the road? The answer is because he saw John Ash coming.
I'm going to use that.
You may. I'll bet any time you're near a chicken, they head for the hills.
Yeah. I don't know if they're smart enough.
Well, anyhow, I mean, I always liked that book. What's it called? A chicken and another one in the oven or something like that. I can't remember who wrote it even, but it was a great book all filled with chicken recipes. But it didn't go into this detail. I mean, you have the history, proper handling and storage. You even, this hot new thing is people raising chickens in our backyard. I even checked on that, and we're not far enough from the property line because we live right smack in the center of the town.
Yeah.
But people are doing it all over the place.
Yeah, and we included in the book, too, things other than chicken. So that the rest of the poultry that people run into, like ducks and turkey and geese.
And you do eggs, too.
Yeah, and eggs. Yeah, as we thought, going back to the chicken or egg thing, I thought, well, we have to have eggs, so do egg recipes.
Yeah, and it gets expanded to things like grilled asparagus salad with pancetta and fried egg, which is, something that's become very... Papa, there's a book out on putting an egg on top of everything. I can't remember what
I think it's the trend right now. Yeah.
Right. But you do, like, things that are not so common, too. You do a big spread on chicken and turkey, as you should. And then you do the other ones, like ducks. And you talk about the difference between farm-raised and wild ducks.
Yeah.
Goose is a big one.
Goose is, and it's not something that Americans typically cook much with, but quail and squab and all of those things, which, interestingly, restaurants do a lot with, but for some reason, home cooks, unless you're a hunter or something, tend not to, and partly because we don't find them regularly in the market, though they're widely available. So part of the encouragement of the book is to try some of these. You know, it was interesting. I was asked if I had to have a last meal, what would it be, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I think it would be squab, because I think it is so delicious when it's cooked properly.
I like it. Your recipe in lettuce cups, because that's one of the ways I like. We were just talking about my mother as a little girl. She came from a family of hunters, and she said that she was eating these small birds, and she had no idea what they were, except that her father had shot them, and it turned out they were robins.
Oh, dear.
And she was traumatized totally.
Yeah. Quite funny, I include a recipe from my brother in the book on quail. It's wild quail because he's a hunter. And it's a very simple recipe. But the first instruction is to make sure that you remove all the buckshot.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's standard, right?
Well, Americans are not familiar with the date on the British calendar called the Glorious 12th. You are.
No, I'm not.
The Glorious 12th is the first day of grouse season in Scotland.
Oh, right.
And if you're very favored, you get to go try to shoot some. Sort of like Dick Cheney was doing whenever he shot his friend. And there's a race for who can kill the grouse and get them to London restaurants fastest.
Oh, faster. So it's like Nouveau Beaujolais or something.
But you have to be really careful how you bite on the 12th of August. It might be on lucky 13th, you might break a tooth if you're not careful.
Right. Oh, that's great.
When we were leafing through your book, I was reminiscing about partridge, which is also not very common. Peter remembered, when we had that. We've had it once, and we did have the escabeche in Toledo.
I think it's a regional specialty of Toledo, and it was vinegary, and it looks very much like the recipe that Em was reading from your book.
Yeah, it's so interesting that especially in Europe, the game birds, all kinds, are much more common both in the market as well as in restaurants and things than they are in America. I think, you know, for all of our becoming foodies in America, for all of our adventurousness, we're still fairly limited in things that we'll eat and all of that stuff. So players will encourage people to try some of these, maybe these birds that they haven't tried before.
Have you seen any of the European markets, like the one on the Rue Claire in Paris, where they have the game birds hung and most of the plumage is still on?
Right.
Well, they're not allowed to do that anymore. That's EU.
Recently, apparently, the EU powers that be started insisting that most of the plumage be removed.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Just for something to do.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, even in our Chinatown in San Francisco, where I live close to, it used to be that they would hang all the birds there with their feathers on and guts in them and all of that kind of stuff, and the health department has required now that they can't do that anymore.
Okay. Why is that?
They must have been listening to the guys of the EU in Brussels.
Yeah. What's that?
Well, I think the concern, you know, it's health concerns and all of that stuff. But sometimes I think it's a little crazy, because if you go to China, for example, or Southeast Asia, you know, they've been dealing with birds that way for years and years. I think it's kind of the same argument, unfortunately, about unpasteurized milk in cheeses that are less than 60 days old. And I think that's something they're even trying to do in the EU, is to force that throat to the French and the Italians, who I don't think will let it happen. All in the name of sanitation.
Now, John, what was your concept in preparing this book aside from, obviously, you had a lot of recipes to get off your chest.
Yes, I did. Well, it was really, interestingly, it wasn't my idea to do this book. There's a contributing author to the book. His name is James Fraioli.
Yes.
Who actually came to me with the idea and said, you know, I think that there are lots of books out there on beef, and there are lots of books out there on other topics, you know, other proteins and things like that, but nobody's really done a good book on poultry and birds and all of that kind of stuff. So he said, do you want to tackle it? I thought, well, yeah, that would be pretty interesting, because I think in the doing of a book, yes, I know something about it, but of course, when you commit to doing a book, forces you to learn a lot more and really dig in more deeply to the subject. And I think what was great about this was, especially now with all of the new terminology that we face in the marketplace about what's free range and what's naturally raised and do these things mean anything and all of that stuff and how are birds handled, all of that. It was a chance to sort of get caught up on all of that verbiage, too.
Well, you support, of course, the sustainability and you deplore factory farming, as we all do who are in this business. But there's that bottom line for producers. What do you think's going to shake out from all of this?
Well, I tend to be an optimist. And what I'm seeing, what we're seeing, at least we're seeing in California, I can't really talk about so much about the rest of the country, but in California, a really heightened consciousness about, if not organic, at least
natural.
Whether it's birds or anything else, things that have been what I call ethically produced, you know, that they're given a life to live that isn't cramped up in a crowded cage someplace, all of that stuff. And even processing practice, it's been for such a long time the standard that chickens especially were, after they were harvested, they were immediately thrown into ice water, which is not a good practice at all, number one, because the meat absorbs a lot of moisture and stuff like that, so it doesn't cook as well. But also it's not the most sanitary way of dealing with it. And so one of the things that's happened in the last couple of years, and I would encourage everybody to demand this of the chicken that you buy, is this whole concept of air cooling of birds after they've been slaughtered, because it's a much more sanitary practice, and also the when you cook the things, having to cook out all of this absorbed water. And so that's a tip in the book, too.
Do have tips like that. We should mention that, which I think the storage and handling thing, I truly believe that. I was watching our son prepare chicken, and he washed his hands 3 times. He's so phobic about microbes.
His wife also takes all the skin off.
which, for heaven's sake,
is the best part.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, actually, we got a recipe in the book from a friend of mine. And it's funny, it's kind of showing up in special places.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm just eating crisp chicken skin.
Oh, yeah.
Skin off and do it all by itself.
Sean Brock likes that. He does that on his menu.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if I have a recipe for skinless chicken thighs, I buy the ones with the skin on, take them off and fry the skins in them. Skins are fabulous.
Yeah. No, they're really good.
And people, the supermarket charges $1.25 a pound more just to take the skin off.
Well, the other revelation, I think, for a lot of people, which I talk about in the chicken section, is the importance of chicken feet. We always you think about, it's like, where do all those feet go? Because in most supermarkets, you never see them with their feet on. And, of course, they become now, they're a specialty in Chinese restaurants,
right,
you know, to cook. And also, they're the best things to make stock with, because they yield all of this wonderful gelatinous flavor and all of that that really prize in a stock. And so what's happened here locally for me is the chicken feet have become almost as expensive as chicken breasts, because there's such a demand from the Asian restaurants to use them in both stock making and in their special dishes. So
it's like buffalo wings at $3.99
a pound. I mean, I'm sure you remember, I do. Boy, wings and feet, they were cheap. They'd almost give them to you.
I want to share with you, I think, what is probably the world's wildest voicemail message ever left. This is from a Chinese restaurateur. The specialty at her restaurant was duck feet. And she called me one day at the office, and the call went to voicemail, and she said, "This is Jenny. I have duck feet for Anne."
That's great.
So I called her back and I picked them up that very day.
Now, let me ask you a question, John. Sometimes now when we get the chickens, right, or even turkeys, I think. No, not so much turkeys. Well, yeah, but, I mean, I happen to be really fond of gizzards. How do they distribute these innards? Because, I mean, did they take them all out and then sort of at random pick through and stuff them back? Or what? I get lots of chickens with no gizzards at all. Several livers, no heart.
Yeah. I think it's just that the conventionally, commercially processed chickens are doing so many at a time that they don't keep track of them. And livers, for example, they'll pull those out because they can sell them separately. And again, and gizzard also are things that tend to go to ethnic communities, especially Asian, who love gizzards a lot. They braise them for long so they get them tender. And so it's funny how you don't get a complete, you often don't get a complete trick anymore.
I used to buy gizzards separately in the terminal market in Philadelphia. And I don't know anybody selling them now.
Yeah. I remember two things we got. I think we had them at the same restaurant. One was chicken coxcombs.
Oh yeah.
And then the other was, what was it? Was it chicken testicles or something like that?
I don't know. Yeah.
They're sort of white, soft, fluffy things.
Yeah.
Would they be testicles?
They could have been. If they were testicles, they'd be from a rooster, But yeah.
Well, whatever. I mean, they were on the menu at a very fine restaurant called the Champignon Sauvage in Cheltenham, in the southwest of England. And the chef said, "You've probably never had these before. You should try them."
Yeah, don't tell me what they are. Just serve them up. Yeah. But what I was going to say, and a lot of that with the rise in popularity of certainly Japanese restaurants, those that specialize in yakitori. And in Japan, the classic thing there is when you go to one of those restaurants is that they marinate and then skewer and grill all of the parts of this, could be the liver, the gizzard, everything, the Pope's nose.
I love that too. You know?
Yeah, that's the first piece to go when I get the chicken out. As soon as I turn my back, the parson's nose is gone.
Yeah.
Well, this has been fun, John, and this is certainly a welcome addition to a total reference, I guess I should say, on what to do with birds.
So we're glad your co-writer had a good idea.
And
you followed through on it, and thank you so much for joining us today on the radio. It's been
welcome.
Fun talking to you.
You're welcome. Fun talking to you, too. Thanks.
And we'll be back right after the break, so don't go away.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and I can't tell you how happy I am to have this book. Duck, duck, goose. I mean, it answers.
Did he ever explain the title, by the way? Why was it two ducks and only one goose?
Oh, you know the game.
Oh, no,
duck,
I don't.
Duck, goose. Well,
there's
it's a
game.
Children's game.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
It must be an American children's game.
Probably.
Or an Italian children's name. It's not.
But at any rate, I mean, Hank Shaw is, I guess the word you could describe, intrepid, but also endlessly curious. And he explained things in this book that I didn't know I didn't even know. I loved it.
And you didn't even know you wanted to know.
Oh, and I do. I want to have it all.
Well, you have most of it.
Yeah, and he called us from where? He's always on the move. He's on this book tour.
He was on his way to Fargo,
South Dakota.
North Dakota.
Oh, North Dakota.
From Bismarck, South Dakota, I think.
Okay.
and it had been snowing, as you probably read in the news.
But he's an outdoors person.
He tends to do that up there. I guess you don't mind if it's snow, if there's snow on the ground, it's easier to spot your duck after it falls out of the sky.
And they
do that. They grow a lot of geese in South Dakota, too, as we knew from Hank's friend and our friend, Mr. Schultz, and his family, who have 300,000 geese in South Dakota. That's a story for another day. We'd better just get on with what Hank Shaw had to tell us about duck, duck, goose. Is that like rock, paper, scissors?
I think. I don't know.
All
putting
right.
me
well,
on the
See, you don't remember either, and I never knew it even existed. So let's have Hank go away with his part of the story.
Knowing Hank Shaw, I don't know why I'm surprised that his new book, Duck, Duck, Goose, is so sensational, so important, and I just love it, Hank. I guess I didn't realize there was so much I didn't know about birds.
Well, when I started writing it, I didn't. I mean, the book is something of an exploration, even for me, and I've been cooking ducks and geese for many years.
And you're a hunter, a fisherman, a forager. You actually have a blog.
Hunter, angler, gardener, cook.
Okay. And then your last book that we interviewed you about was Hunt, Gather, and Cook.
Right.
And your blog won a James Beard Award last year, this year, 2013, for the best food blog.
I did.
Right?
I was pretty excited about that.
That's amazing. That's wonderful because there's so many of them. I don't know what the ratio was or the odds, but congratulations.
Thank you.
Walk us through why you wrote this book.
Well, there's two reasons. As you look through the book, you'll notice it's kind of a combo book. It deals with both wild birds and domesticated birds.
Right.
And for the main reason why I wrote it is because duck is really coming on the scene right now. There's a lot of people out there who think duck is the new pig.
Yeah, do you think that's true?
I do, because as various and as interesting as all of the pork, you know, magic that's coming out of chefs right now, they're doing the same things with duck. Because duck has the amount of fat, it has very different kinds of flavors depending on what part of the duck you use. It's a very interesting animal to work with. And what I've been seeing over the last few years is chefs all over the country, way outside the capitals of San Francisco and New York and Chicago, are using duck in their menus on a regular basis. No longer uncommon to see duck in restaurants in places like Billings or Fargo, which is where I'm headed to right now.
Well, are they...
And a lot of that is coming down to, you know, and so the what it's spread to is now duck is becoming more and more available in regular supermarkets. So for the first time in maybe 50 years, duck is accessible to home cooks as well.
But there are many ducks in this book that I've never had access to whatsoever, and they're not coming out of supermarkets.
Right. That's the other part reason I wrote the book. Is the other reason is because I am a duck hunter. And one of the great conundrums of duck hunting is it is a great, you know, it's a hugely rewarding pursuit to chase duck. But a great number of duck hunters don't know really how to cook their birds. And so this book also is a guide for someone who has access to those wild birds.
Yeah, when you talk about some of these birds, and then you, with little tips on things like, well, there was one that was, I thought was really funny. Was it the mallard? It was unusual. And, you know, I always thought a Muscovy duck was from Russia.
It has a weird name, and nobody fully understands why it's called the Muscovy. But you would think it would be from Russia, right? But it's actually from Central America.
Right.
Isn't that funny? Now, have you tried the new breed of duck that Aran Dugan is?
Rohan.
Oh, the Rohan?
Yeah.
Yes, it's a wonderful duck.
Yes, we interviewed Ariane about that, and I loved it. I mean, I didn't care so much for the preseason things, breasts, you know, but I liked the basic product a lot.
I do too. I think that Rohan duck may be the perfect duck.
I think so too.
It's big. It's got just enough fat. Its meat is dark. It is sort of the most well-rounded domesticated breed I've ever eaten.
Right. I think it's fabulous. And, you know, the other thing was I never understood. I've always bought Magret duck breast from Ariane, but I didn't know what it came from. I didn't know that it came from a different duck.
It is. It's from the Moulard.
Yeah.
Those are the foie gras ducks.
One of the problems with duck for the uninitiated, after they cooked it for the first time, the biggest problem is how are you going to cut it up? It is quite a carving challenge.
It's just different enough from the chicken where it can confuse you if you've never done it before. That's definitely true.
So you have recipes for whole ducks, but you have recipes for bits of ducks too, I guess, right?
I do.
And one of the ways around the problem of carving it up, I guess, is to have it cut up before you start.
I honestly, even when I cook a whole duck, and we're talking about store-bought ducks here, when I cook a whole duck, I will often take it out, cut off the breast midstream, and then put the rest of the duck back in. The problem with ducks are, let me backtrack for one second. If you want to know 90% of what you need to know about cooking ducks and geese, the first thing you have to remember is they're not actually birds. They look like birds, but in the kitchen, they're not. They're beef. Exactly. I mean, the breasts are like steak, and the legs and wings are like brisket. If you remember that, you're 90% of the way there.
Yeah, wasn't quite sure I understood that. You made that comparison. But brisket has all that fat, and the legs don't, do they?
Oh, yes, they do. They're coated with a beautiful layer of fat.
Oh, okay.
And they can melt away just like like pulled pork or like a brisket or like barbacoa. But they do need that slow and low moist heat, whereas the breasts need hot, fast, high heat.
Okay, yeah, so that's very smart. Now, a lot of people cook turkeys that way, too, and we got an interesting lesson for that one year when our local slow food chapter decided it would do a
heritage breed.
Heritage breed turkeys. They didn't take the breasts off and cook the thighs longer, as they should have, but I remember you could only cut the breast. You couldn't actually cut the heritage breed thighs at all. But Anne scored one to take home, and thought she had gotten this great treat for us. It was
wild turkey.
You couldn't cut a piece of meat off it with the sharpest knife we had. And it had been cooked for like 4 hours.
You get especially the drumsticks of a wild turkey. They can be so sinewy you can use them as dental floss.
Oh yeah. Now let's go back to you are giving this is an essential book, as far as I'm concerned, for anybody interested in cooking duck or geese. Or in fact, you carry it even further. You deal with the giblets, sausages, charcuterie, duck fat, and duck eggs too. But you start off at the very beginning with some really honest, straightforward, practical stuff. Like if you shoot a duck and your bullet pierces the intestines, don't hang it.
Exactly.
See, I mean, that's common sense, but who would ever think of it?
Well, the problem with common sense is it's rarely common.
Now, how would you even know, though?
Well, you feel around.
Okay.
You know, right. when you come home and you decide which birds to hang and which birds not to hang, you give them the once-over while they're still in the feathers, and then you make your decision.
Well, let's get real basic. Why do you hang at all?
Well, the reason you hanging any kind of meats, whether it's beef or venison or game birds, is to essentially tenderize them through, how I delicately put it, controlled rot.
Yeah, I love that. Because, you know, Peter was crazy over potted,
The reason you do it
is
because of old birds. And, like, you wouldn't do it with a store-bought chicken because they're very young, but waterfowl, even domesticated geese, are the better part of a year old. So that tenderizing step can go a long way in giving you a better experience when you get it on the table.
You said you have to have perfect conditions. First of all, you have to leave the guts in and don't even attempt to hang it if they're pierced.
Right.
Keep it unplucked while you're hanging it, because if you pluck it, the skin will dry out. And you have to have a certain kind of a temperature, otherwise you get bad bacteria or no good bacteria.
Well, there's a sweet spot between 40 and 60 degrees.
Shoot. I mean, I don't know, that's for something for amateurs, Hank.
Well, you know, I mean, the book is everything from a primer for amateurs to, you know, I'll admit it, there's some pretty advanced stuff in that book as well, but I wanted it to be useful for everybody from all ranges of experience.
Well, now we understand a little bit about why the ducks or the birds hanging in Paris the bird market along the Seine, they used to be hanging there with all their feathers on.
Mm-hmm.
And since the EU came in, now they're all plucked.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, mostly plucked anyway, and it's probably counterproductive to the quality of the product you get when you take it home, because you can't very well stick the feathers back on again.
No. I mean, it's just, you're pretty much done.
And we had this funny experience, Hank, one year we were in Paris, and we were intrigued by these birds that had all the feathers. Some of them still had a lot of the feathers
on.
And Anne wanted to know why they hung them with the feathers on. Well, now we know the answer to that. But she tried with her not very good French. She went into a shop that had all these turkeys that were hanging with the feathers on, and tried to ask the butcher
why
they did it that way. And he thought that she wanted the feathers. He offered to give her a rather large quantity of feathers. so he was in the process of plucking one, and she was happy. He was happy for her to have the feathers if she wanted them.
Yeah, now you have a whole section on how to pluck. You think of everything. Like, don't pluck it in your kitchen because your spouse will get really mad.
I learned that one firsthand.
Now, why is that? Because it makes a mess.
Oh yeah, I mean, the feathers get everywhere, and it's not like, I mean, even a pheasant would be easier, but the problem with waterfowl is they have down, and down flies all over the place, and
okay.
You know, you'd be picking down out of the cupboards for months if you plucked it indoors.
I thought very interesting was this little call-out section where you had that test of fat, flavor, and terroir. Do you want to explain?
That was fun.
Yeah. And what did you find out?
What we found out is that there really is a sense of terroir in wild birds, especially. And, I mean, it would apply also to domesticated if the feed is different. But, you know, everybody knows that you are what you eat, right?
Yeah, so you go into a lot of that.
Wild birds most certainly are that. And what we found was that even the same species of bird, in this case a mallard, would taste different depending on where it lived, because its diet might be different in the hills versus near the ocean versus in the grasslands versus in the marsh. And we did a blind taste test, and there was noticeable differences between each one.
Well, you know, I never even thought of it. How do you check now to see if they've eaten crustaceans, but they turn out to be smelly and not tasting very good?
Yeah, there's an easy test for that one. If a duck has been eating sea life of some sort, the fat will most certainly be, almost always be orange, and you will definitely smell it. Now, there are exceptions to that. We brought home some bluebills from the San Francisco Bay last season that had just come down from the north where they had been gorging themselves on clams.
Wow.
And the fat was white as snow, and I was very shocked to see that. So I ended up roasting a couple of them whole, and while you definitely could tell that there was something oceanic going on, it was more of a saline brininess than a kind of an icky fishiness. And we kind of liked those birds.
I'm not sure about including this, but I have to. Did you make this up, this quote from Confucius that said, "Man who stand on hill with mouth open will wait long time for roast duck to drop in"?
I did not make it up. I don't know if it's an actual Confucius quote, but it has been attributed to him a lot, so I thought I'd use it.
Oh, dear. Okay, so you tell us all about how you prepare wild, and you talk to us. I didn't know, for example, that in the United States, I guess it's USDA, does not allow any hormones or antibiotics used in ducks like they do in chicken. Why is that?
Right.
I mean, I know why I don't like the antibiotics and the hormones, but why did the USDA, of course, in their infinite wisdom, decide that it was okay in chickens but not in ducks?
I think there's two reasons. I think, one, it's more difficult to raise ducks and geese, especially, in intensive conditions. It does happen. But you can't treat a duck like you can a chicken. They don't survive. So that extends into hormones and antibiotics. Ducks, for whatever reason, don't handle them very well. They tend to die. So part
really?
Of it is practicality.
Well, you see, I mean, you want them dead, but you want them dead under controlled conditions, I guess.
Yes, you don't want them to die of disease.
Now, one thing that amazed me, and you mentioned the people from, I think it's Schiltz in South Dakota in your book, and they told us that the domestic goose was in fact domesticated, was the second animal to be domesticated after, I think, dogs, and they had been flightless.
Hank says the first.
The first, okay. Well, I think the guys from Schiltz said they thought dogs might have been domesticated first, but the goose, some of them fly, some of them don't, and many of them don't. Am I right?
Well, I mean, all geese that are living today fly. I mean, are you talking about migrating?
No, we wanted to know why all these geese on the Schiltz farm
didn't fly away.
And they said they were free
running. They're perfectly happy to stay there.
Okay.
And what they've done is they've bred out the urge to migrate.
Oh, I see.
It's sort of an instinctual urge that ducks and geese almost all have. And it's one of the difficulties of breeding ducks and geese is breeding that urge out. And part of the way to do it is to give them everything they need where they are, so they have no reason to migrate.
I'll be darned.
Okay, so I'm really wrong. So ducks actually can fly. I mean, geese actually can fly. They just, some of them choose not to.
That's true in a lot of cases. Now, some farms will pull out their flight feathers, the feathers right on the end of the wings to prevent them from flying, but not everybody does that.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, there you go. Well, that's new information, and I thought I had the right answer, and I don't. Now, you've got some rather non-traditional recipes in your
tradition you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, twists on tradition.
I mean, traditionally, you take a duck or a goose and you roast it. But you have, is it Italian duck meatballs?
Okay, that one's non-traditional, I admit it.
Well, tell us, like, I want to get this out, you know, about the book. Is it not only is there all this technical information that you need if you're going to be cooking all these birds, but in addition to that, you have fabulous recipes. I mean, really delicious, creative recipes. Sometimes just off the top of your head and sometimes variations on traditional. Can you mention a couple of your favorite recipes here?
Sure. I mean, the thing I loved about writing this book is that it's essentially around the world and beak to feet, right? So almost everybody eats duck. The Muscovy duck was domesticated in Central America. You know, the regular domesticated duck was first tamed in Southeast Asia and geese in Egypt. And so that you have all of these old traditions of eating ducks and geese all over the world, and it was just so much fun to tap into it. For example, one of my absolute favorite recipes in the whole book is this Chinese drunken duck soup.
Oh, yeah.
And you roast a whole duck, roast it, slow roast it, sort of the old traditional way where everything is well cooked. And then you break it down into pieces, and then you build a soup out of it that is just out of this world. Once the weather gets cool, I make that soup, I don't know, maybe every other week during the whole duck season. It's just so warming and wonderful, and it's a very old traditional Chinese recipe. Flip around the world, there's a German smoked goose breast recipe called the Speckgans, which is so good. It's like crack, it's so good.
Oh, wow.
And it just, there's so many of these just revelations that I had as I wrote the book that I honestly didn't get tired of eating ducks and geese while I was making
the
book.
Yeah, you must have eaten quite a lot of them.
Oh, yeah.
So, well, Hank, as always, I'm really just thrilled with what you do, with your knowledge. And I'm always impressed with how much you know.
And well, I appreciate you having me on the show.
Yeah, well, and Peter's going to find out how he can carve now with your section on how to carve it.
Oh, he's got a section there?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I didn't get to that part.
I do.
Well, thank goodness for that. Then I'll know.
Step-by-step photos.
Yeah. We'll do it. Well, Hank, thank you, and have a good book tour and a lot of success with this book.
And Thanks a lot. And if you're ever want to come to any of my book tour events, I'm going to be on the road all the way until the end of January.
Oh, my God.
So chances are I'm going to be near you at some point.
Yeah, I saw the list, but I don't think you're near me. Anyhow, if not, I hope we touch base again soon.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Hank.
Take care.
And don't go away, because we'll be back with the answer to the question, why should you put an egg on it?
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Now, Laura Ferroni did not ask the question, should we put an egg on it? She was very certain that
we should put
an egg on it, she says. And, in fact, she does that in 70 delicious recipes. And if you can't picture that, you're going to have to see this book.
You know what? I realized that she never answered my question about why chefs call the eggs they put on top of things hen's eggs.
Oh, right. We still
don't understand that, because they're obviously not cockerel's eggs, because that's an impossibility. So we're really not sure what the story is, but maybe she'll come back sometime and she'll answer the question, or maybe she dodges the question because she doesn't know the answer. That's certainly possible, I guess. So when you see an egg on the menu and it's called a hen's egg, don't. Well, if somebody will tell you the answer, would you call us or send us an email and let us know? Because we're burning to find out, aren't we?
Oh, yes.
It's absolutely the most important thing we need to find out between today and tomorrow. And in the meantime, here's
Laura Ferroni. We've talked to you before. Now, you were a prolific cookbook author, are you not?
I have a few.
Yeah.
I have a book on donuts and snacks.
Yeah, and of course, you really were early into that donut stuff. It's become big time now.
It has. I've been amazed at how many new cookbooks on donuts there have been in the last 3 years.
Yeah, we just got another one on
cupcakes. I thought we had passed that, but I guess not.
We're not talking about that today.
No, we're not talking about that today.
Let's get back to the subject.
Okay, but anyhow, Laura is in Portland, Oregon, which is a really exciting food town. But that doesn't have anything to do with this, or does it? Your new book called Put an Egg on It, 70 Delicious Dishes That Deserve a Sunny Topping. And it certainly is a sunny topping, an egg.
Definitely.
Yeah, now we talked a bit about, I mean, this has been a European tradition for a long time. Is it just catching on in the U.S.?
I don't think so, but there's never really been a cookbook that's ever focused on it before. I think when you go into most restaurants these days, it's kind of a chefy thing to put an egg on one of the dishes. I know that whenever I go to a restaurant, if there's something that has an egg on it, that's the thing that I order almost every single time. It's like, oh, look at that. It's got an egg on it. I'm going to want to eat that. It's been around, but I think that people don't necessarily think to do it at home, and it's a really nice way of upping up just some ordinary food and making it something really special.
Now, it's worth the trouble to get really good eggs to do this, right?
Definitely. You definitely have to use very good eggs.
Well, you have a section, actually, that's sort of a primer on dealing with eggs, buying and storing and cooking and cracking.
That's right. So knowing how to prepare the eggs well definitely helps when you're adding it to something. So there's lots of tips on how to boil eggs and as well as poach eggs or scramble them or fry them.
Now, I was going to skip over this, but I think I'm going to put you on the spot and just say that your egg basics, you subtitle Get Eggucated. That's pretty sick.
Yeah, I did have a little bit of fun with puns.
So anyhow, what is the biggest mistake people make in selecting eggs?
I think that fresh eggs make a big difference, and so I think most people don't know how to buy eggs and make sure that they're fresh. So looking at the date on the carton, which can be a little bit tricky to figure out because it's in a strange format. It's not like when you buy milk, the expiration date is really obvious, but when you buy eggs, you have to do a little bit of math to figure out how fresh they are.
Oh, you do now.
It's a lot better if you go to the farmer's market and then you buy your eggs from the farmer who is raising the chickens, which is what I definitely recommend if you have that option.
Now, we've found something interesting that, in fact, in restaurants, especially if they're featuring eggs on the menu, they'll describe an egg as a hen's egg, but I thought they were all hen's eggs anyway. Chickens laid eggs.
I mean, I certainly try to avoid commercially raised eggs when possible. I don't know exactly what I've never been to a big commercial hen house. So I don't know if they're, I doubt they're hand-picked in that situation, but certainly if you're working with a farmer, then they're.
You have more than one bird's eggs in your recipes.
Yes, I do. Yeah, so I cover quail eggs and duck eggs as well as chicken eggs. Any of the recipes can just be made with a standard chicken egg, but I really enjoy duck eggs for their rich flavor. And then quail egg is nice because sometimes you just need a little bit of egg. If it's just a little bite of something, you want just a little bit of egg on
it. What about a goose egg? I mean, they're big enough to feed two people, right?
I've never done anything bigger than a duck egg. I will eat a duck egg on my own.
And now, how about seagull eggs? Haha.
Who eats those?
We had those in London, if you remember.
Did we really?
Yeah, they're in season only for about 4 or 5 weeks. They're
Where
very
did
special.
We eat those? I don't remember.
At the Something Street Tavern. Can't remember the name of the street now.
Oh, okay. Well, if you say so, were they very good?
Yeah, they were very interesting.
Yeah, no, I mean, you have a section on egg safety, which everybody gets concerned about, and then also on refrigerator not.
Right.
And, of course, all of our relatives in England, nobody puts their eggs in the refrigerator.
Right. Eggs are, before you buy them, they're prepared differently here typically than in Europe, where particularly if you're buying it from the grocery store, they've all been power washed. And that changes the shell a little bit, and so any egg that's been power washed really does need to be stored in the refrigerator, or it does have a greater chance of getting bacteria into that shell.
Oh, I see.
Versus if you just are getting them from your chickens in the backyard, that's a little bit different. It's still up to individuals to decide whether or not they feel comfortable storing them on the counter or in the refrigerator. If you are going to store them on the counter, you should definitely eat them while they're fresh. don't leave them around for a couple weeks.
Fresh lasts for how long?
I think for fresh, you should eat them the week that you have them, particularly if you're going to store them outside the refrigerator. If you store them in the refrigerator, you can store them for 2 to 3 weeks.
And you have different preparations. How to crack them. You come down in favor of cracking how?
Well, I did have to crack a lot of eggs for this book.
Yeah.
I went through a lot of eggs.
So I read sometimes chefs, especially important chefs, always take on this issue of whether you crack them against the bowl or crack them against the counter.
I typically crack them against the counter because you have less chance of getting the eggshell back into the egg, and it's just a much neater process. And again, kind of going back to the egg safety, you really want to try it. I mean, you should give your eggs a little wash anyway before you crack them.
Oh, I never thought of that.
Get some of the eggshell into, particularly if you're not going to cook them, if you're going to have them on the less cooked side.
Yeah, but of course, everybody's trying to, except I found that we can't do that. We don't have enough land to meet the requirements for chicken coop. We're right in the middle of the city, so I'm not too surprised. So you have all these baking and coddling and pickling. You don't have sous vide, do you?
No, I thought about it, but I think I even bought some components to do the perfect sous vide egg, but it's not something that most people have at home. And
you know what it tastes like? Coddled egg is what it tastes like.
Right. It's a lot of extra work for a difference. I'll definitely say I've had a perfect sous vide egg before, and it certainly is delicious, but it's not something that most people are going to do at home. I might do something on my website about it.
Now you take people through essentially every meal with suggested recipes, so it's not just sort of throw eggs around willy-nilly. This is not just fry an egg or boil an egg or coddle an egg. This is
there's a whole combination of recipes. Some of them are very simple, and some of them definitely are more work, but all of them, I think, benefit from the addition of the egg. But there's soups and there's lasagna. I mean, a lot of things that a lot of people just make on their own anyway. Chicken pot pie with an egg on it is a revelation.
Oh, wow.
Goes beyond just hamburgers and pizza. Risotto, it's like a creamy tomato risotto with an egg on it is delicious.
Growing up, my favorite, my mother used to be fixated on asparagus, and she would make asparagus soup, not creamed, just asparagus soup, and poach eggs in the soup.
It's delicious. I love that. I love cooking an egg in the soup. The pork stew recipe that I have in the book
has that same thing.
Yeah,
I like your blasted cauliflower with eggs.
Yes, the blasted cauliflower is excellent on its own, but the eggs definitely make it a little bit special.
Yeah, cauliflower is becoming a huge star.
Now, let's talk about the eating of the egg.
I was just flipping through the book again this morning, and I was, like, getting hungry looking through. I mean, this is definitely one of my favorite books. I want to make every recipe all the time.
Now,
even after making so many egg recipes, I still want to make them all.
Now, the idea is that you cut the yolk and you let it run all through the food. Is that the idea? When you're actually eating an egg recipe and there's an egg on top of it, you deliberately want to cut the yolk and let it run through all the rest of the food?
Most of the food gets prepped and then the egg will go on top, but some of the recipes involve a little more egg incorporation.
No, I'm talking about when you actually eat the dish. So let's suppose I've got an egg on top of something. Here's one right here.
Oh yes, the peanut butter and jelly. I really wanted to do a peanut butter and jelly sandwich with an egg on it, and it took me a little while to figure out how that would actually taste good.
Yeah, it sounds really disgusting.
it does, except there's a food cart here in Portland that does really interesting peanut butter and jelly sandwiches that have all different kinds of flavors. They don't have one with an egg on it. But they are the ones that inspired me with they have a Thai peanut butter and jelly, and I'm like, well, if it's Thai flavored, then it's a lot like Pad Thai, and that kind of has Thai flavors with some peanut and a little bit of sweetness, and that's got egg in it, so could I do something around that? And it's actually very, very delicious.
Well, I think that the summation of this whole thing is that you haven't found anything that wouldn't work better with an egg.
In fact, my biggest problem was cutting off a number of recipes, and I found myself, like, after my manuscript was in, I went, why didn't I do a baked potato with an egg on it? Why didn't I, you know, I came up with another 30 recipes that I really wanted to go and make.
Well, now, if you come up with an idea like that, are you putting it out on your website or on your blog?
Yes, I will be. I've been super busy, and my blog is a little out of date at this moment, but I have plans for it over the next week to get some updated dated recipes up there.
And I must say, you also have desserts.
I do. I think that desserts deserve an egg, too. Most of them are meringue-based, although one of them is more of a custard. I think one of my favorites, actually, are the little meringue cookies that have the lemon curd in it. So there's a lot of the egg yolk in the lemon curd, and then the white baked meringue, so it looks like a fried egg. It's a lot of fun.
Now, what was it that was on the plate that's at the end of the book? No, I'm not looking at the one with the cracked eggs.
No, I'm just talking about how she's winding up the book. She tells us it's coming to the close because there are all these empty shells of cracked eggs, and then she has the empty plate.
So what was on the empty plate?
What was that? That was actually one of the breakfast bowls that I had. I think it was a white bean, like a cannellini bean with herbs and an egg in it.
Yeah, I think we ought to mention that I looked clean. You look clean. But I think we ought to mention that you're not only the food writer, but you're also a photographer.
And, I am,
and
yes.
And that talent shows in this book, because it's a visual treat as well as having really interesting recipes.
Well, that's one of the things I actually really love about eggs as well, is that visually, whether it's the whole egg in the shell or a fried egg or a poached egg or anything, it's just a visually beautiful subject as well.
Well, here's a recipe from and Peter that you can include on your blog, and you can put it in your next book, Eggs Part 2. It's called Soft-Boiled Eggs with Lentils.
Spicy lentils and hemp seed. Spicy lentils and toasted hemp seed on soft-boiled eggs.
Yum.
Yeah, I know. It's so good.
You have to have since it's for breakfast and you want minimum preparation, you have to have a bowl of leftover lentils with hemp seed.
Yeah.
Just sitting there in the refrigerator, and I suddenly remembered there isn't any in there, so I better make some tonight with dinner.
Absolutely. Well, it definitely is putting an egg on something leftover definitely sort of gives new life to it, and it's great for people that are busy because it doesn't take much time at all. You know, even if you just boil a pot of spaghetti really quickly and do sort of a deconstructed, throw a little bacon and an egg in there, and you got a great dinner there, too.
Well, I adore eggs, so anyhow, I think that I'm a natural.
I hope you enjoy the book.
I probably could work my way right through it because I love eggs.
Yeah, we're sure we will, and we thank you for this contribution to the world of gastronomy. All the hands in the world are applauding because after all, you've given them the reason to continue their lives rather than finishing up in a pot themselves. So thank you very much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. And
thank you,
listeners.
It's great to talk to you.
If you like eggs, this is one you got to get.
Oh, this is a great book. Yeah. Okay, Laura, keep
great.
On cooking and shooting.
Thank you very much. I'm heading back. I'm working on a peach cobbler right now that I'm shooting for a client.
Oh, great!
I get to have a pretty yummy dessert of lunch today as well.
Oh, that's good. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Good to talk to you.
So for today, the birds have it, as they say?
Is that what they say?
I suppose. I don't know whether they say that or not. I just said it, so it must be true.
I don't even know what going to the birds means.
I think it's somewhat similar to going to the dogs, but perhaps a slightly smaller
degree.
Maybe
I have mixed whatever. It's not a metaphor. Mixed whatever.
Sayings. An adage or an axiom or whatever. I never can figure out what. Things your mother used to say.
Right.
Okay, so on that theme of things our mother used to say, we will say to you goodbye until next week and have a good time and join us again, same time, same place.
Bye-bye.